Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit coderedroofers.com.
Welcome to today's No Restraint podcast. I'm Joyce Kaufman, and I am not in the mood to be trifled with. When I look at what's happening around America today, particularly on these college campuses, I am screaming inside. More than 200 protesters got arrested on Saturday at Northeastern University, Arizona State University, Indiana University, and Washington University in St. Louis. That's according to the officials, because colleges all over the country are struggling to quell these growing pro-Palestinian demonstrations and encampments. These are not pro-Palestinian. These are anti-Jewish protests. There have been more than 800 arrests of protesters on campuses since April 18th, when Columbia University had to have the New York Police Department clear an encampment there. In several cases, most of those who were arrested, especially those at Washington University, were already released. Now, that university was locked down on Saturday evening. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for the 2024 presidential election and a real nut job, was among those arrested, along with her campaign manager and another staff member, according to the spokesperson for the campaign. A Northeastern spokeswoman, Renata Nile, said the demonstration had been infiltrated by professional organizers and that the use of virulent anti-Semitic slurs, including "kill the Jews," crossed the line. Protesters denied both claims, and a video appears to show that it was a pro-Israel counter-protester who used the phrase as part of his criticism of the pro-Palestinian protesters' chants. In response to that video, Ms. Nile stood by her initial comments, adding that any suggestion that repulsive anti-Semitic comments are sometimes acceptable, depending on the context, is reprehensible. After protests had been removed from the encampment by the police and then handcuffed and brought into a nearby building, they moved to a block, a nearby alley, where police vehicles were parked. They cheered in support, and one of the arrested protesters, wearing a Northeastern sweatshirt, waved through the building's windows with zip-tied hands. Alina Cordell, a sophomore at Northeastern University, reiterated the protesters' demands that the university disclose its investments and divest from companies that protesters view as supporting Israel's war in Gaza. "We want them to divest our money that we're paying for our tuition," Ms. Cordell said. "Our administration is not listening to us." First of all, who's paying that tuition? These lunatics or their parents? Ms. Cordell said she believed the vast majority of students in the encampment were Northeastern students, along with a large amount of Jewish students and faculty supporting the protest. By 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, the majority of the encampment was cleared. A moving company had been brought in to load up the tents, snacks, and other items that had been scattered throughout the grounds. Where'd those tents come from? The mass arrest at Northeastern was the second early morning crackdown on protesters at a Boston campus in less than a week. Early on Thursday morning, Boston police officers arrested 118 people at Emerson College after protesters refused to move and formed a barricade. More than 2,500 miles away, at Arizona State University, the school police arrested 69 people early Saturday morning after they set up an unauthorized encampment, which was in violation of university policy. The school said the protesters had created an encampment and that the group was instructed multiple times to disperse. While the university will continue to be an environment that embraces freedom of speech, as long as it has to do with killing Jews, Arizona State University's first priority is to create a safe and secure environment that supports teaching and learning, according to school officials. Three people were arrested at the school in relation to the protest on Friday, officials said. At Indiana University in Bloomington, where the university police had arrested 33 people at an encampment earlier this week, campus and state police arrested 23 more protesters on Saturday. Officials said that a group had erected numerous tents and canopies on Friday night with the stated intention to occupy the university space indefinitely. Schools across the country have used differing strategies over the past week to tamp down these protests. Some have backed off and sought to de-escalate tensions, while at other colleges like the University of Southern California and Emory University, the police have rushed in to break up encampments and arrest students and faculty members, among others. At some demonstrations, there were some reports of injuries, but in many cases, the arrests have been peaceful, and protesters have often willingly given themselves up when officers moved in. On Saturday, there appeared to be an increased police presence in several campuses, though not all of them have made arrests. At the University of Pennsylvania, more than a dozen campus police officers were stationed among barricades with over 100 protesters in an encampment and about a dozen pro-Israel counter-protesters across the campus walk. Across the country, at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, officers were stationed all over the now-closed campus after protesters occupied two buildings earlier this week. About three dozen protesters were inside an encampment. Beyond arrests, schools are using other measures to apply pressure. At Harvard, access to its historic Harvard Yard was restricted, allowing in only those who showed a university ID. The university also suspended a pro-Palestinian group, but the group and its supporters set up an encampment in the yard nonetheless. On Saturday, Harvard's Dean of Students sent an email to the student body warning that anyone participating in the encampment face discipline, but there was no sign of any impending police operation. At Cornell University, the student newspaper, the Cornell Daily Sun, reported on Friday that four students connected with the pro-Palestinian encampment on campus had been suspended from the school. Cornell officials confirmed the suspensions were issued, but declined to provide a number. In a statement on Saturday afternoon, the university's vice president for university relations, Joel Molina, said that the school had asked the protesters to move to an area where noise would not disturb classes and where people could easily avoid the encampment, but he said that offer was rejected. Mr. Molina also said the university was prepared to issue additional suspensions as well as referrals to HR for employee participants. Nick Wilson, a student who said he was among those suspended, said in an opinion article for the Cornell Daily Sun that he and others had been withdrawn from their current courses and that they were not allowed on campus. Still, he wrote the suspension, in an odd way, gave him hope. By his reasoning, institutions like Cornell would not have suspended him and others unless they truly fear our movement may be successful. How did this all begin? Well, I read an article by Gary Wexler that I'm going to share with you that really does tell you how this all began. You see, the brilliant Palestinian plan to capture the pliable minds of American college students was actually laid out in front of Gary Wexler 25 years ago during a very sinister business meeting in Israel. He writes, "It was around the time of the Oslo Accords. I had been hired by the Ford Foundation to create a marketing institute for their grantees in the country. Ford was funding the operations of both Jewish and Arab organizations within the Israeli Green Line in an effort to help build a vibrant liberal civil society. Ford put me in partnership with a young Israeli woman, Deborah London," according to Gary. Deborah, now one of his closest friends, has just been selected to head up fundraising for the rebuilding of Kibbutz Be'er. She and I drew up a plan to interview each of the grantees as well as Israeli ad agencies and media firms. While we wanted to learn about the grantees, we also planned to secure free marketing work and media to be an essential part of the institute. "When we interviewed the Jewish organizations," he said, "the atmosphere was almost giddy with hope and possibility and belief in Shimon Peres's new Middle East. Each organization we interviewed talked excitedly about peace and coexistence, a flourishing economy among both the Jews and the Palestinians, collaborative projects, and interchanges. But when we interviewed the Arab organizations, the word peace never passed their lips. They spoke of independence, dignity, self-rule, a state. One person even told them she would never use the word dukayam, coexistence. There is no such thing as coexistence, she stressed. We are just the tenants living on the property that the Jews now own. That's not a balanced coexistence. I tried to explain to my fellow Jewish liberals that we, the Jews and the Arabs, were having two very separate conversations. We were talking peace on the Jewish side, and they were talking independence on the Arab side. But the weeks of interviews progressed, and more I found the Arab organizations were talking about a whole lot more. I asked hard questions of both the Jews and Arabs in the interviewing process, said Gary. With the Arab organizations, when I brought up any sensitive and not so sensitive issues like terrorism, cooperation, and even budget, the interviewee would slam on the brakes. And then, from each organization, the same words were spoken. When you are in Haifa meeting with Itija, you can ask that question to Amir Makul. Itija was an Arab civil rights organization. Amir Makul was its executive director. It became clear to them that Amir Makul had some type of control over all the Arab NGOs that they'd been speaking to. Finally, Deborah and Gary arrived at those offices. Skinny, bespectacled young Amir Makul emerged from his office, took a look at me, and said, "So, this is the Gary Wexler who has been asking all the questions." And then he ticked off every question I had asked, along with the name of each person I had posed the question to. He brought us into his office and began pacing. "So, Gary Wexler, let me answer your questions in the following way. One, Gary Wexler, who is sitting in front of me now, went to the Los Angeles City College for 2 years, where you were an Israel activist and editor of the school newspaper. You wrote a lot about Israel and continued to do so at California State University Northridge. You spent 5 summers as a volunteer on Kibbutz Ayalat HaShaluhar."
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Through your marketing agency, Passion Marketing, you service the following clients of the Jewish world and in Israel. He named every single one. I knew this guy was trouble. "And now, Gary Wexler," he sat down, "let me give you more direct answers." He looked me straight in the eye. "Just like you were a Zionist campus activist, we will create over the next years," this was 25 years ago, remember, "Palestinian campus activists in America and all over the world, bigger and better than any Zionist activists. Just like you spent your summers on the kibbutz, we will bring college students to spend their summers in refugee camps and work with our people. Just like you have been part of creating global pro-Israel organizations, we will create global pro-Palestinian organizations. Just like you, today, will help create PR campaigns and events for Israel, so will we, but we will get more coverage than you ever have." He stood again this time, right over me. "You wonder how we will make this happen, how we will pay for this. Not with the money from your liberal Jewish organizations who are now funding us, but from the European Union, Arab and Muslim governments, wealthy Arab people, and their organizations. Eventually, we will not take another dollar from the Jews." Then he got real close. "What do you think of this?" "I took a breath and I remained professional," said Gary. "Nothing. I'm here on behalf of the Ford Foundation, collecting information for a planned marketing institute. He came even closer. I am asking, what does Gary Wexler think of what I just said? You, Gary Wexler. I repeated my answer. He came even closer. I ask again, what does Gary Wexler think of what I just said? Deborah and I got up. I took my writing pad. I feel that you are threatening me, and we are leaving. The next morning, I received a call from the program officer at the Ford Foundation. Gary, we have a problem. We received a call from Amir Makul, and we understand you spewed out all sorts of Zionist propaganda, and he felt very threatened by you. I told him it was a lie. The program officer continued to press me as to what I had said. I related the conversation word for word. He repeated what Amir Makul had said. I told him to call Deborah London, who was with me through the entire interview, and verify it with her. I also told him that they better check their funding to these Arab organizations because Amir Makul appeared to be controlling all of them with some very hateful behaviors. He backed down. Deborah and I wrote up our recommendations for how they needed to build the marketing institute, including a recommendation for using the pro bono work worth nearly a million shekels that we had secured from the ad agencies. The program officer, a former academic focused on the nonprofit sector, couldn't understand the value of businesses being involved and rejected it out of hand. A few weeks later, he told Deborah and me that he had hired an NGO consulting team to finish the work. They would be giving several hours of consultation to each organization. Several years later, I learned Amir Makul had been arrested by the Israelis as a spy for Syria. As the years went by, I began to see what Amir Makul had laid out to me taking shape. The PR coverage was first. The Mohammed al-Dura incident in Gaza, when a 12-year-old boy was shot to death on the second day of the Second Intifada, capturing global headlines. The Mavi Marmara, the Turkish flotilla to Gaza that the Israelis stormed, killing several Palestinian activists, grabbing global headlines. I knew the Mavi Marmara was manufactured for the exposure it would gain. Then the campuses, the creation of Apartheid Week worldwide, the growth of BDS, the student volunteers who began by the thousands to work in the Palestinian territories and its refugee camps, the shocking creation of anti-Zionist Jewish student groups. As an award-winning copywriter and creative director in ad agencies and a professor of communication at USC, I have developed an intuitive antenna to detect similarities between writing styles, idea styles, and conceptual creation, says Gary. In the early years of this pro-Palestine campaign, I could see the commonalities of excellence, style, and manipulation across all their platforms. Teaching on a university campus gave me a front row seat at this theater of darkening skies. People of color, particularly anti-Semitic black groups like BLM, were organizing to identify with the Palestinians. Many organizations representing people seen as oppressed were moved to identify with the Palestinians. Students of every variety were swayed. I could see the commonalities of language creation and transfer, my field, being applied to the Jews. Many of them were old anti-Semitic tropes into which new life was being breathed. Israel and Jews are colonialists, just like other white oppressors around the world. Israel is an apartheid society, the same as South Africa was. Jews have white privilege, even though more than 50% of Jews are dark-skinned people from the Arab world, Iran, and Africa. Jews hold power in media and banking, making them the enemy. Jews center themselves as capitalists and donors. Jews don't hold space for anyone but themselves. Jews need to be held accountable for the pain they are causing. If you challenged any of this, you were a racist, the worst thing you could possibly be accused of. Except if you're a racist against Jews, then you prove you are a true ally of the oppressed. Our enemies have had a real success. They have formed a winning international communication army with trained troops everywhere. Israeli writer, producer, and former anti-Semitism envoy Noah Tishby recently said that students, particularly Jewish ones, who are protesting against Israel have been played. But I don't know if even she understands the background and extent of it. They haven't just been played. They've been turned. Many of them are alumni of Jewish day schools and camps. Those students believe they have joined the other side because they were the victims of a propagandized Zionist education and have now seen the light. No, they are the victims of a propagandized, slow, well-crafted plan laid out to me 25 years ago by Amir Makul, said Gary Wexler. And what has been the Jewish world's response to all of this? Funders are now putting up pro-Jewish and pro-Israel billboards in American cities, as if a clever one-line message can combat all these brilliant, strategized organizing efforts on behalf of our enemies. Others are organizing TikTok and Twitter troops, but that work is in response to the playing field that has been established and won by the enemies of the Jewish people. We are showing ourselves in a defensive mode. We're playing on the field they have drawn. We need to draw our own in a very big way. There are many good organizations being funded and working on behalf of the Jewish population, but their work alone is not the answer. It is imperative that they have overall strategizing and coordinating. Right now, it is every organization for itself. It's an uncoordinated battlefield where each squadron is moving in its own direction rather than toward the same hill. The only way for victory, it is imperative that we create big, brilliant, creative ideas of engagement. We must view this as a pervasive Jewish community organizing effort for communication purposes in collaboration with the Israelis. In the last 3 weeks, I have received no fewer than 200 solicitations for 200 separate efforts. American Jews are sending cans of food and socks to Israel, while the Palestinians are conceptualizing bigger and better worldwide actions. We're still fighting and demonizing one another. Many organizations have not yet woken up that it is no longer business as usual. People are on boards of one that you have to rattle them, saying, no, we cannot position what we are doing just as we always have. Everything now has to be repositioned against the background of this war on Israel and the Jewish people. In the propaganda war, we could be learning a lot from our enemies who have learned a lot from us. Maybe we need our own Amir Makul and all his buddies. Is any leadership team that we can all get behind going to step forward? Look, my fear is that civility, which is something that the Jewish population always prides itself on. Oh, we're not going to stoop to that level. We need to be bigger and better. We need to use our brains and not our brawn. Well, let me tell you something. If you've not been paying attention to the world since October 7th, then you are useless in this battle. I've been paying very close attention, and I can tell you this. If we don't develop a winning strategy, and we don't push back, and we don't shut down these encampments and these anti-Semitic groups, including anti-Semitic Jewish students on college campuses all over America and coming soon to the European Union, let me promise you one thing. The Holocaust is going to look like a dress rehearsal for what's about to happen to the Jews in the world. I don't understand why it takes a number like 6 million to get people to sit up and understand that Jews are always the canary in the mine. First they'll come for the Jews, and then they'll come for you. So if you're not Jewish and you're not fighting, you still have no excuse. I'm one of these people who see what's unfolding in America today and across the Middle East as a real signal to get ready and to get mobilized. Because if you don't, if I don't, if we don't, this is just the tip of an iceberg that is going to be so ugly. Remember, Hitler did not have the kind of weaponry that is available today to the haters of Israel and Jews. There's not just nuclear weapons and drones and all of these horrendous missiles, which eventually a lot of these deterrent systems like David's Sling and like the kinds of systems we've seen work historically, like the Iron Dome, they will not be sufficient to take on the actual person-to-person chaos that I believe is about to erupt. And if you think this is only going to affect Israel and that this is going to stop on some magical day when enough Jews have been punished for what these college campus idiots think is a crime that they never even committed, well, let me tell you, history has shown me over and over again that it's never enough to just push back a little. You've got to win the war. And the only way that we'll be able to win this war is for all people of good conscience to stand up and reject this anti-Jewish rhetoric that seems to be coming at us from even our own families. Trust me, they know what they're doing. It's us who seem to have no clue how serious these problems really are. I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm not willing to live through a Holocaust of Jews. I didn't live through the first one, but I am definitely a result of a dynamic in Jewish people and even in Christian people that was forever changed in the 1930s in Germany. Well, this is not the 1930s in Germany. This is 2024. And when I look at what's happening on college campuses, I know what a Hitler Youth movement looked like then, and I can see what it looks like now. So get ready, get ready, get ready. You're being summoned to the wall. You've got to push back. If you don't think this is a battle worth fighting, well, then please make me one promise. You will get out of my way. And here's another thing I'd like you to promise. Think about this when you go into the voting booth in November. Which president, Donald Trump or Joe Biden, will stand by the Jews and push back against this rabid anti-Semitism? I don't think I have to tell you the answer to that. I don't care how dumb you pretend you are. If you enjoyed this No Restraint podcast, I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but if you felt it was valuable, please spread it around and wait till next week when we do it all again. May God bless you. May God bless Israel. And may God bless the United States of America.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.